Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 676, July 2023.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell, and this episode is about a recent film release. It is 2023. That's what I mean by recent. Spider-Man : Across the Spider-Verse, yes, the sequel to Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, the excellent movie from a few years back, from 2018. I'm just going to say this up front, because we're going to spoil the movie. That's going to happen. We're going to talk about things that happen in the movie. I don't think it spoils it, but people call that spoilers anyway. I want to mention, though, that this movie was originally titled Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse Part 1. They changed it to not say Part 1. I want to be clear, it is still Part 1 of a two-part story, the second of which doesn't come out until next year. Anyway, they hid that from me, which, you know, given that I just recently was in a movie theater and the trailer for Mission Impossible played, and it reveals that the Mission Impossible name is, what's it called? Mission Impossible...
Across the Mission Verse,
Dead Rogue Reckoning,
Rogue Fate, Dark
Dead
Fate.
Dark Fate. Yes, Mission Impossible: Dark Fate. It's Dead Reckoning is the name, and so I'm watching the title, the trailer, and Dead Reckoning Part One comes up, and there is laughter throughout the audience at Part One of a movie. So maybe Across the Spider-Verse, maybe they were wise to hide that it's Part One of a 2-part movie. Anyway, let me tell you who is joining me to talk about Across the Spider-Verse, formerly Part One. Lisa Schmeiser is here. Hello.
Sorry, I can't talk right now. I'm thinking about my past.
Shannon Sutterth is here. Hello.
Hello, and I also question why the horse needed a mask.
Well, in a world of horses, you wouldn't know. Anyway, Chip Sutterth also joins us. Hi, Chip.
This is all of us, all of our webs weaved together.
Wow.
In podcast form.
In podcast form, sure. And John Syracuse is here. Hi, John.
Hello, Danger.
Look, the Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is a great movie, a classic movie. I feel like when people asked me about this movie after I saw it, I struggled to describe my feelings for it because I really enjoyed it. And I think, and we're going to talk about all the things that are in it. And I think it's a beautiful looking and well executed movie. I struggled to describe it though, in part because I think that how do you follow an act like Into the Spider-Verse, which basically stands alone. And I really do think is one of the great animated film accomplishments ever.
I was actually campaigning for it to be Best Picture in 2018.
And it won the Oscar for Best Animated Film. I like this movie, but I was torn when I tried to describe it to people because I didn't want to damn it with such faint praise that I said it doesn't screw it up for the first movie. but the bar is so high that I did struggle with that because, like, I don't know, you kind of only can see Into the Spider-Verse once, and it was such a mind-blowing experience, and this movie is more like, well, it's more of that, but you already had that, but there's more of it now. And I don't know, I struggled with that a little bit. How did everybody else feel about coming into this from that previous film?
I agree that, yeah, it expands, it builds, it takes the foundation created by Into the Spider-Verse and just goes further. I mean, if you accept the premise that there are, you know, multiverses, multiple dimensions, and every dimension's got a Spider-Man, and then it's like, well, what does that mean? And what next? And I mean, it felt very true to like comic book logic of, you know, coming up with more characters, a reason for these more characters to be around. And it worked for me. I also feel like some of the things I've seen some of the animators and people share on Twitter that I think they always conceive this hopefully as a three-part story. And I think they sort of, you know, planned for it that way. So I feel like they're building pretty well.
I'm sure we all read C.S. Lewis in the Chronicles of Narnia series, right?
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah. So if you don't go in chronological order, but rather publication order, and I feel like I have to distinguish
as
that.
As you should.
Yeah, because I feel like you have to distinguish that because there's always going to be somebody who's like, the magician's nephew should come first, which, no. But you know how you read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and you get introduced to Narnia and some of the internal logic and the characters and the conventions, and then the book after that is Prince Caspian. There's been this tremendous leap forward in time. The characters who were in the last book, the four main characters quickly realize time has passed. Things have gotten complicated. The world that they thought they knew and mastered had expanded. And it's just different enough where you find yourself drawn into the challenges and things getting increasingly complex. But it's not too complicated so as to be off-putting. And it's not too overstuffed. And I feel like it's a similar experience going from the first Miles Morales movie to this one, where a lot of the really familiar beats are there, like Miles and his family, Miles's adolescent struggles, and him trying to juggle all his expectations. And I love how it just kind of got turned up to 11, where things are getting more complicated. He is growing up. He is learning what it means to miss people all the time. And I was really relieved at how much I liked it.
Yeah, same here. I think that this movie is what if Into the Spider-Verse, but more. And at every level, it's at more. It's longer. The characterizations are deeper. The complications are more complicated. It is in every way sort of an expansion of and a deepening of everything that was established in Into the Spider-Verse. You can't go back, though, like you said, Jason, about, you know, you can only see Into the Spider-Verse once, that one first time. And it is so concentrated genius that by taking time to expand the story and to make it more interesting in a lot of ways, you're still not recreating the straight into your veins experience of watching the most perfect animated movie ever. Animation in this movie is better than Into the Spider-Verse, and yet I think that Into the Spider-Verse is my favorite of the two, and this is simultaneously a better movie than Into the Spider-Verse. It's very complicated.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that the animation is better in as much as the directors and the producers and the artists were incredibly clever in using what they learned in Into the Spider-Verse to expand. Like, you know, there is sort of like a cohesive visual to Into the Spider-Verse, since that one, it takes place entirely in Miles's dimension. And right away with the opening with Gwen, we see there's a different color palette. There's a different feel to the characters, to the movement, to the backgrounds. And that kind of care is taken to show individuality, to, you know, in how the characters are animated and how the scenes are set up. So, you know, it's just they have taken what they have learned and they're using it very well.
I'm glad Jason started off this whole thing immediately hitting on the one and only thing that bothered me about this movie. And I didn't know it was supposed to be titled Part One, but that makes a lot of sense, is that I felt like it didn't tell a complete and satisfying story as a middle chapter. Like, I remember when they were getting towards the, you know, what it was effectively the end of the movie, I'm like, is there another hour of this movie coming? Because it just feels like they're kind of in the setup part. And the movie, when I was trying to talk to people about this, I had the same problem talking to people because I love the movie, right?
Yeah.
But when people ask me about it, the top of mind thing is I love the movie, but I didn't want to say, be aware that, if I had known it was a part one, yeah. Mm-hmm. If I had known it was a part one, I would have said, be aware it's a part one, but I didn't want to spoil it to people, right? And so when I've been talking to people about this, like, oh, well, what didn't you like about it? I thought you said you liked the movie. It's like, yeah, but I didn't feel like it told a satisfying story. And they're like, oh, well, it's a middle chapter, so on and so forth. And I had to start pulling out the comparisons. I'm like, okay, Kill Bill, Volume 1, right? It's half of the movie. Part 2 needs to be there to complete the story, but Part 1 feels like it had a satisfying internal arc. And Kill Bill, Volume 1 is like just a couple of notches off a list, off a kill list, and the kill list continues into the second movie, but still it feels like there is, a setup, a challenge, a thing to overcome that is eventually overcome. It's a climactic battle. There's a feeling of resolution, even though, of course, the story is not over. Empire Strikes Back, my favorite Star Wars movie. It's a middle chapter. That feels like, nothing's resolved. At the end, they're still on the medical ship, and it's like, what's going on? But still, it feels like Empire. There is a challenge. There is a beginning little battle thing, and then there is a challenge for Luke, and he confronts Vader, and that feels like a climax, and there is a resolution to that battle. But there's still more to come. And so I feel like, there's probably other examples as well, that just something about this, it didn't feel like they put the right pieces in this story to be a complete story. Now, on the other hand, Empire Strikes Back comes back a lot because I agree with what other people have said, is I think this movie does everything that Spider-Verse does, but better. Just like Empire did, spaceships finds your space, we're going to do that even better in Empire. Lightsaber battles, we're going to do even better. Like, everything about this was better. And that really surprised me because I thought, okay, as long as they don't mess this up and it's a good story, it'll be fine. I did not expect them to up their game that much in the animation department. Both in the look of the thing, which is like, how can they top Spider-Verse, but also in like the literal animation, like remove all the color from the screen, make everybody stick figures. The literal animation was better. Just the way the shots were staged, the way things were animated, it was just, I was blown away that in the same way that I bet people who saw Star Wars in 1977, which I did not, or if I did, I don't remember it because I was like three, thought there's no way they can top that for Empire Strikes Back. And then you go see Empire Strikes Back and you're like, what? Like, they did everything better. This movie literally does I was just so amazed that they upped the game. And here's the big thing about it. I think the animation not only was better, but, and this is going to sound weird if you've seen the movie, more coherent than Spider-Verse. Even though obviously there's so many different universes and so many different looks, I felt like there was a more confident hand on the steering wheel to say, yeah, we're going to have 8,000 different Spider-Men from many different universes, but you're still going to feel like, I don't know, there was a consistency that everything looked good and appropriate for what it was. And just that really blew me away. So it's so hard for me to talk about the movies. I'm like, oh, just wow, it blew my hair back. But if I had to say, is this, quote unquote, as good a movie as the first one? No, because the first one told a complete story and this didn't. Now, maybe when the second one is out and I say, if you watch all three of them together, you can take them as a unit, but it's weird. I have weird feelings about it.
Is it just because of the cliffhanger? Or could it have had a cliffhanger in a different way and you would have been more satisfied?
Yeah, no, that's what I'm trying to get with like the Empire thing, because Empire kind of ends on a cliffhanger too. A lot of movies, it's not the fact that it was a cliffhanger. Fine, be a cliffhanger. It's that I felt like what was in this movie felt like the first half to two-thirds of a movie in terms of plot arc, right? It was lots of setup, lots of early act revelations. And it's like, if you say like, what is the arc? What is the story in this movie? I mean, the major thing that is learned is you weren't supposed to be bitten by the spider, and there are canon events, Gwen confronts her father, and we find out about the other Miles, and that's all the type of stuff that happens in like the first half to two thirds of a movie, and then there's got to be some climactic battle.
I do feel like there's a little bit of an internal arc though, because the through line is Miles juggling the expectations that his parents have for him and the expectations that the school has for him and the expectations he has for himself as Spider-Man, and always feeling slightly out of place no matter where he is. And then it kind of ties into the revelation that he's literally out of canon because he's not supposed to have the spider powers he has. And It's comic.
So how does that resolve?
Everything is a metaphor for adolescence. It's a man versus himself story that basically got resolved.
So you're arguing for the train, which I love the sequence, by the way, the big train going up to the moon or whatever, like the big rocket going up to the moon, that is essentially the climax where he says he's going to do his own thing and defy the canon event.
It's Miles' growth story, its climax, I believe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yes, there's more to come that, you know, there are things that have to be fixed and things that have to be solved. But because Miles has arrived at this point where he knows who he is.
He's going to write his own story. That's what he says. I'm going to make my own story. And that's him working out the story that he tells with his mom in his head. And that's why you have the scene where, and I love the scene in the reveal, where he talks to his mom and he mentions that he's Spider-Man. And you know this is important for him and this is the denouement. And then the twist happens and you're like, oh my God, he got sent to the wrong universe. And like, I'm not even that worried about the cliffhanger, to be honest, because when you see that he's like getting ready to fire up the sparks, this is a guy who has somehow managed to like make that developmental leap.
Character-wise, I think it's a complete story. Plot-wise, I grant you, yes, there's more to come and we need more. But that's where I feel satisfied.
I think we're going to see Gwen's development in the next movie because Miles has a pretty complete arc. Gwen's, although she has like that little bit of resolution with her dad, so much of the story gets put into place because she's got all of these big, messy, spiky feelings that she's avoiding or redirecting. And all of those have come home to roost by the end of this movie. So I think we're going to see her facing up against that and dealing with the repercussions and figuring out her character arc in the next one. So I actually
think that she has a complete character arc in this one. So this is why I'm much more satisfied with this as a movie than as a self-contained movie than John is. Cliffhanger notwithstanding, you've already talked about Miles's arc, and he takes to heart the lesson that his mom taught him about not letting anybody else tell him he doesn't belong. For Gwen, she goes from running from her father, trying to find a home, to having this transition into deciding that she's got to rebel against the Spider Society. And her arc comes to a close at the end of this movie, having put together a new band and inviting you to be in it. So I really like both her arc and Miles' arc. I think that there may be some conversations that we could have about whether she pulls too much focus from Miles, especially the beginning. But I do think that you have two very important character arcs that come to a resolution. Miles at the train with some follow up, and Gwen right at the end of the movie. And then, you know, slap a to be continued after you see Miles getting ready to zap his way out of the chains. There are issues with the movie, but I still think it's a great movie, and it did resolve itself sufficiently for me.
Yeah, I feel like Gwen's arc was more complete than Miles's in this particular movie, and I'm not thinking with my analytical mind when I have this feeling. Like literally, when I was watching the movie, I was confused about how much time had passed because it just didn't seem like that the movie was going to end. And then I looked at the time like, they're going to have to end. The movie's about to end. And I just felt like I didn't feel like it was resolved either. It's because I just wanted to keep watching more of it. It was totally 100% a gut feeling. And then I had to back solve and say, well, why did I feel that way? And that's when I'm trying to make comparison to movies that I love that do something similar. Like, oh, they're not a complete story. Why do you think this one's okay? Why do you think that one's okay? And that's where I'm making the comparisons, but just gut feeling. It didn't feel like it felt like almost all the things in the movie were set up in intermediary things. And the fact that Gwen, you know, the secondary character, got a more complete arc seemed also natural to me, because very often you resolve the secondary character's arc sooner or in a secondary way to the primary character's arc. It may have also suffered from Return of the King syndrome, in that the sort of we finished our story, but now we have to set up the next movie part. kind of felt like they were about to start a new segment, but then the movie really does end, right? And that's fine and forgivable, I suppose. But like, it was the stuff that came before that just didn't, it didn't feel to me like the movie should be ending at this point.
It's the fake out decision, I think, that is also at work here. Plus the fact that, yes, this was absolutely developed as one movie that was so big that they split it into two and then they changed the name of it. So it literally is half of the movie. But I think the choice of, you could argue that if this was a true sort of standalone movie in a series, if that's not too contradictory, he goes home. He says, I'm going to do my own thing. He escapes. He takes the dial home device, basically the go home device, and he goes home. And if he had gone home and saw his mother and said, I am Spider-Man and all that. And then
and
then we had the revelation that like, oh yes, but the spots out there and Miguel O'Hara is trying to get,
you can even reveal that he's in the wrong universe as the final movie ending stinger.
Well, this is the thing is, I think by making it that he's in the wrong universe, it's trying to do that thing where like you think a movie's coming to rest and right. Instead kind of yoink, it's not. Now, I have a hard time judging that because when he does the dial home device, it flashes 42 and they had already sort of like hung the lantern on the fact that the spider was from 42. And so you're like, okay, he's not going home. And so I wasn't surprised by that twist. And so I can't say how that reaction would be, but like, that's what I think they're trying to do there. I think the movie is very satisfying, but I don't mind the fact that it ends on a cliffhanger. I knew they were making another movie that was coming out next year, so it didn't bother me too much. But I do feel like it almost needs a warning label on it saying, just so you're aware, this thing is going to stop hard, and then you're going to have to wait until next year to watch the rest of the story. I do think it's a satisfying movie, but I think it is surprising in that way that it is... I mean, we've been talking about it a lot. Obviously, it engenders some strong feelings here. Like, does any movie that's part of a giant franchise really come to rest? I think what you want is something that feels like you're telling a story within a larger story. And honestly, like, Avengers Infinity War is like this too, right? It has an ending, but if that's the ending, wow, it's grim. And I know some people reacted that way, right?
Do you remember the flood of pop culture commentary and reviews where all of these people were like, I just sat stunned in my seat. I was incomprehending. And, like, they were seriously surprised that Avengers Infinity War would end like it ended. But what? How?
Folks, there's another movie next year. Of course it ends.
And the thing is, at this point, we all know how the MCU works. There's nothing that stands alone.
I think maybe a lot of people just have an expectation that they're going to get the whole, even if it's part of a larger whole, that it's going to be rounded off a little bit at the end. And what we get here is a true, proper, I would say very good cliffhanger, which is Miles, we're going to jump all around. We'll get to other stuff that's in it, but it's like Miles is in the wrong universe. His dad is dead in this universe. His uncle is still alive in this universe. Yay. But he is the Prowler in this universe. Miles is. And then secondarily, Gwen has assembled the anti-
Gwen
Spider
has assembled
squad
her friends
to go,
from the first movie.
To go take care of Miles and save the universe and the multiverse and all of that. And that's how it ends. It is a proper, I would say, good cliffhanger. But I think a lot of people are really just conditioned to the idea that if I buy a ticket to see a movie, I mean, look, I read science fiction novels too. The same thing happens. You get to the end and you're like, what? Because it turns out, oh, this is a 5-book series.
I was going to argue the opposite, which is that since we've all lived through Avengers Endgame, at this point, we know that cliffhangers are now part and parcel of a multiversal
narrative
thing.
I think Infinity War had a more rounded off ending. Like it had a natural ending point. And the thing is, with this particular movie,
is that Thanos snapped and then we got to watch people turn into
charcoal. Everybody
flakes.
Lost.
It's the same as Empire. Our heroes are down and out. Our heroes lost this one, but we know they're going to fight again. But there is a decisive, like, the battle is over for this movie. Like, you know, Vader versus Luke is over.
I think this movie actually sticks the landing. And I'm probably in the minority in that one. But I think the fact that Miles is able to bounce back from the sheer existential shock of seeing that he's about to get tortured by himself and that his
his dad in this universe is dead, which is, it's got to do your head in, and that his uncle is alive and led his other him into life of crime. And then he's still like, okay, here's how I get out of this. Boom. Like, the Miles Morales at the beginning of the film probably would not have been able to do that. So I think it ends because it shows you Miles's character growth and his ability to face scary things and think his way out of them. And like you said, Gwen gets the Spider-Ham team back together, and we're going to find out how to resolve Miles and canon. It's, I really thought that as in terms of endings go, it leaves you wanting more, but, and it sets up the stakes for the next movie, but it's also super satisfying to see what happens with Miles and Gwen.
You know, the thing is, if I was making this movie, I would probably make the same choice, sort of sacrificing the middle segment. And it's because one of the things I liked best about this movie is how much room there was to breathe in the middle.
Yes.
Especially the scenes with Miles and his family.
Yes.
And Miles talking to Gwen. And if you tried to, like, compress this and round it off more, I think a lot of that would have got squished a little bit. Like, that's part of what makes the ending feel abrupt, because they let that part breathe, which essentially extends the beginning middle of the movie, and then there's not really enough room left for a proper ending, so it ends the proper ending, in my opinion, so it ends that way without, as Jason said, being rounded off. But those sections that got room to breathe, I love that. I feel like once the third movie comes out and we don't really have this problem, because if you're bothered by it, put right. in the next movie, right, that we will appreciate that this thing being allowed to stretch out and breathe.
Yeah, I would strongly disagree with somebody who said, oh, they should have cut, you know, some of that slow stuff earlier in the movie, so that they could have had more at the end. It's like, no, that's the point here. And yeah, I had that thought as I was leaving the theater. I actually thought, if you didn't, because it's also very long, right? I mean, it's 140 minutes, but why is it long? It's like, well, first off, there are lots of Spider-Men, so there's that. But also, like, the opening, the movie has the confidence, and this is all engendered, by the way, by the fact, including the fact that it looks better and that they did all of the stuff with it. It's like, well, you make the first movie on a limited budget where you're taking a risk, and then it's a hit, and it becomes a cult hit, and it wins an Oscar, and then you get more to do more, right? But you also get that confidence about, like, now everybody gets
team,
what we're
the
doing.
The team that built the first movie
exactly.
now is better at
exactly.
doing this.
So they're like, you know what? We're going to dial it back as if, what if we told the first movie, but we told it about Gwen? We're going to take the time. Everybody knows Gwen from the first movie. We are going to take the time to show her story in something that isn't the, you know, let's do this one again, quick cut, 1 minute version. We're going to do it, and we're going to see the complication of her life. And like, another movie, a less confident movie, a movie that was more concerned about running in 90 or 100 minutes wouldn't give us that. And I treasure all of that with Gwen and her dad and the Mary Janes and the Peter dies and that all of those things are, I treasure that we got all of that extra stuff with Gwen, not to mention the fact that we haven't really gone into any detail about here. Gwen's world is depicted in a completely different animation style that is these watercolors that change with the emotions of the scenes. That is just, it is beautiful. It is a work of art. And the character interplay is there, and that they're not trying to rush it. And I think it's one of the strengths of the movie that at many points, especially, yes, Miles with Gwen and Miles's discussion with his mom, the movie takes the time. It's not in a hurry here because it knows it's got another movie. So it's going to be fine. Like, we're going to do what we need to do in this movie. And I love everything it does.
And they still find time in this movie. They have these long scenes with talking with family and having characterization and things happen. And they still find time for like multiple incredibly good action set pieces, like in the same movie, as we spend 15 minutes hanging upside down looking at the city with Miles and Gwen. It's hard to believe that they had, you know, again, that's what time and budget affords you, the ability to do that. So like I said, I think despite the fact that I feel like this thing didn't actually stick the landing, I'm glad that they made this choice rather than trying to make this, because there's no contest to be like the one standalone really good movie. I'm perfectly happy with the first one feeling like a more coherent story. If this one is just a connector, and then presumably they'll have to have an actual ending for the third one, and together they will be, you know, something special. Like, I honestly spent most of this movie just being dazzled that they were doing it better than they had done before, which I didn't expect.
If they slap a to be continued after the next one, I will riot.
Yeah, I mean, they can do that as long as they finish this story arc, then put in a little stinger for like, but wait, there's another big bad to be. I don't care, go ahead. But like, you know, you got to resolve the spot situation.
Yeah, the spot. The Spot is a real Spider-Man villain that I enjoy because it's so stupid, such a stupid villain.
One of the things I enjoy as someone who doesn't know the comics is wondering which things they might have made up for the movie. The answer is usually none of them. Right. All of these things are from the comics. Yeah. If you think it's dumb, don't worry about it. It was dumb in the comic.
Yeah, and so it's a great example. And he is revealed to be the guy who gets hit by the bagel from the first movie, and he lost his job because Alchemax exploded in the first movie, and he blames Spider-Man, and also he got like these interdimensional spots put on him, which makes him a hilariously dumb and bad villain that Miles fights at the beginning.
But is he dumb? Hey, maybe he, you know, if he had been taken more seriously, we could have avoided this.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. He certainly reads as a dumb, ridiculous, certainly a ridiculous power, right? Where the loaf of bread goes through him. It's amazing.
Not, he's not good at using his power, that's for sure.
No, and he becomes first. The MacGuffin.
That's the great thing, is he becomes terrifying by the end of it,
right.
too.
Yeah, when he falls into the realization of what he can do by affecting all universes, and you're just like, oh, damn.
Yeah, but it leads to a, you know, that initial fight between Spider-Man and the Spot.
It's so hard in a while. Oh.
John was talking about these set pieces, like the... Just like I'm committing. Plus, he's supposed to be in a meeting at his school with his parents, right? So you've got this classic Spider-Man, I'm late for a thing kind of thing, and then you've got this kind of weird, surreal battle where things are going through this guy and coming out somewhere else, and all of that is going on, and it's a great it's a great action set piece bracketed by Miles's meeting with the counselor at his high school, because then he has to sort of pick up the battle and continue it. And it's just, it's funny because it is like this is a series that embraces the comic book nature of these stories. It is has the printer's dots, and it has the registration issues and all of those things that are in there, and the editorial notes that happen right on screen. And the Spot, you know, fight is also embracing the sort of like comic booky wild kind of nature of this, but also taking it seriously and the idea of like, well, what can we do? I didn't feel let down by the fight with the Spot. I was like, you've got this character that's got these spots that you go in one place and you come out another. I would have been disappointed if the fight had been more conventional, right? I want it to be, we thought of everything we could do with this power and put it in this fight. And they really did.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
So the meeting that Miles does finally show up at, because it's a very Spider-Man story to have the, you know, you're conflicted, your parents don't know, they think that something's really, really wrong, and turns out, yeah, but it's because you're Spider-Man. That's the thing that happens. Interesting moment in there that I thought was that I really appreciated, which is the counselor suggests that if Miles wants to get into the best colleges, he needs to tell a hard luck story about being a child of immigrants who grew up poor in New York City, and his parents are like, his dad is like, we have a very nice apartment in Brooklyn, and his mom is like, Puerto Rico is part of America,
right?
Just reject the entire idea. But it's also like, it is the movie saying something about the story here about race in America, and like, it's really, there's a lot of layers happening in there, and I appreciated how smart it was too.
Although I'm just like, wait a minute, he's a sophomore and he's already in AP Physics and AP Studio Art. What's going on?
He's
okay.
He's very smart, you know.
He is,
but I mean, there's other AP courses you're supposed to take first.
You know, I find it hard to believe that his parents wouldn't have been having the college conversation with him starting in middle school, but I get why they did it for storytelling purposes.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. And the whole story is about Miles making his own way, and not just finding where he belongs, but claiming his space. And he does it in that counselor's office, saying, you know, I want to go to Princeton. I want to go to Jersey. I want to study other dimensions. You know, this is who I want to be. And that takes you all the way to the train. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna do my own thing. It's a great scene. It's a great important. And going back to what you were saying before, Jason, about, just the amount of time that is spent on various things in this movie. I came out of the movie wishing that it had been a little shorter, but a lot of people have been saying, you should have trimmed some stuff from the Gwen intro. You should have trimmed some stuff from the train chase. Maybe they're looking at this counseling scene. I can't look at any of those individual pieces and say, yeah, I wanted less of that. And I really wanted this scene. Yeah. I really appreciated this scene because it sets up the entire theme of the movie.
My complaint about the movie, if we have one, is... after that, we went and we tried to watch one of the Marvel movies that was streaming on Disney Plus, and just I had a hard time trying to get into it or enjoy it because just the visual style felt so flat and live action felt so incomplete compared to what we had seen. It's the difference between like having a gourmet meal and then someone hands you a bag of Doritos and you're like, okay, I like Doritos. Doritos are perfectly fine. I just ate a really great meal, though. And this is something that I actually noticed in 2018 as well, is when you've got animation and you've got really great voice actors, you have so much more freedom in blocking action, in visual storytelling, in, you know, I mean, set decoration is all part of the art. The character design is all part of it. You can do so much more, and you can do things that are either not physically possible or they're mind-bogglingly expensive. And after you're fully immersed in that for 140 minutes, like, how do you go back to watching something else?
Yeah. Yeah, like one example, it's like, you know, there's when people talk about what animation can do, so often they're thinking about the big, huge things that would be too expensive to do in real life. But there's also, you know, like cartoon physics, not just the concept, the entire concept of the spot, but something like the scene where Miles is finally about to get to his dad's party with the cakes, and he's going up the stairs and he's changing his clothes and he's using his webs to pull the cakes up. I mean, that is literally something that live action can't do at all. It is Bugs Bunny. It is cartoon physics. And it adds an extra dimension to what you can do.
Well, even take a look at Spider-Punk, where they animated different parts of that character at different frame rates. And so there's all of these really... so, and unless you're really, really visually gifted or you know what you're doing, and dude, I'm just a civilian, you were probably not like, oh, it's interesting, we animated some of this at a frame rate of fours and some at threes. Like, unless you know that, all you're going to do is you're going to look at the character and go, okay, there's some sort of kinetic discordant something, like the energy in this character is just, well, punk rock, frankly. Mm-hmm. Like, he feels visually anarchic, and that's something that you can do in animation that you can't do if you were doing a live action movie. I mean, you could try it with FX, but it's not the same as if you're starting from scratch in animation. You could be like, all right, we're gonna show this dude all the way down to the speed at which we animate his guitar compared to his body, compared to his head, compared to when he's moving and when he's sitting still. It was just when I read how they did it, and that's why he looks so disjointed is not the right word, but he looks asynchronous, if that makes sense. And when I read that, oh, you know, there's a reason he looks that way, here's how you do it, I was like, oh, I would have never known. But now that I do, it makes total sense. And I bet there are fragillions of those types of tricks all the way mm-hmm. through a lot of the different sequences that we saw, where they are beautiful and they pop and they're just visually remarkable, simply because the people who are doing the job are like, aha, here we go. I can do stuff that we can't do even with CGI. I can do this now.
Such as, like, you know, even the way they thought so carefully about how each of the major Spider-Men move you know, the Indian Spider-Man, you know, they actually based his movement and his combat on an ancient martial art from India. Gwen moves like a gymnast. We see, you know, Miles's movements have matured. You know, he's doing his own thing still compared to some of the others. And I've even seen somebody shared on Twitter a snippet of a storyboard plan for how Miles the Prowler moves compared to Miles as Spider-Man.
That was fantastic. There was it was an animation test with some scenes built out more than others of Miles and Uncle Aaron basically swinging through alleyways, criming,
with their equivalent of their batarangs or bat ropes.
basically they swinging as though on web lines, but not using web lines, and it's very different. All that movement.
You talk about the movie leveling up from the last one, and I think this is one of those examples where they have a constrained list of spider people in the last movie, and here in this movie they're like, nope, we have all of them, and we're going to, some of them are samey, but they're samey in a joke way, whereas like, I'm Spider-Man, no, really? And then wait a second, is it because your uncle died? Right, like that kind of stuff. But you also get the remarkable things like Hobie Brown, the Spider-Punk, who is animated in a very certain style. We get to see the Lego world, right? Which was animated by a teenager in Toronto, mm-hmm. but it's from the producer of the Lego movie. So why isn't there not a Lego world? You get so many of these different characters and their different styles. Miguel O'Hara, Spider-Man 2099 as well. And so you get this kind of cornucopia, Jessica Drew, who's sort of like his number two. There is a... it's that confidence again, and it's also them wanting to take what they learned in the first movie, because they were doing different animation frame rates in the first movie too, right? But not on the same character, and that's the like taking it a step further. But also, yeah, just having this scope is not something that would have been possible in that movie, but now in this movie they're applying everything they learned and saying, well, we did it with five characters or whatever, and now we're going to do it with hundreds and certainly like a dozen that we're going to put a lot of effort into and get you to know them. And so this is the introduction we get to the spider crew that Miles is not invited to, because we do find out that he is the ultimate outsider, because there was not supposed to be a second Spider-Man in his universe. He was bitten by the spider that should have been in Universe 42, which did not get a Spider-Man at all. And then we get to meet all these very interesting spider characters and discover that Miguel O'Hara basically is a super dour guy who is, he's just a grumpy pants, and he doesn't like Miles, which leads to that chase. There's the train that John mentioned, that's like a space elevator, but also a train. And there's just inventive wild stuff where there's all these spider people trying to chase Miles, and Miles is trying to get away, where he does his, I'm going to do my own thing line, which is absolutely the core moment and of the theme of the movie right there is that, which is Miles is not interested in, we mentioned it in passing, what we learn in Spider-Man India's universe is that there is spider canon and includes losing a loved one and a police captain near them dying. And of course, Miles's father is a police captain, or has just become. And they're like, well, this is canon. Your dad has to die. And Miles is like, nuh-uh, right? Uh-huh. Like, no. And it's such a beautiful moment of like, we're not only is it the meta of like comic book canon, but it's also Miles asserting himself. And it leads to that moment. But there's so many other great, just visual moments in the whole chase. I really like there's a one-liner that's like, guys, he's stuck. He can't get away. And then he gets away. And the guy's like, sorry, everybody. I guess he could get away. It's just, it's just because they're making the line that you see here in all the movies, and then they're underlining it and saying, yeah, but they always do get away, don't they? Just it's so inventive. And I guess this is Miguel O'Hara's world here. It's this futuristic.
Yeah, it's like Nuevo York or something. Yeah. Assuming that's
at least they're telling us that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So that middle segment is just, I mean, it's a lot, but at the same time, it's a real feast. And that's the part of the movie where they're like, okay, you wanted a big expansive action scene. Here you go. Right. Could it be more expansive than hundreds of spider people fighting on a space train to the moon or whatever? Like,
right.
Yeah. It's just all there.
I think it has to be, and I can't imagine how much more expansive it's going to be in the next one, but I feel like they've got to top themselves yet again. And I'd say that Lord and Miller, if they can make the next one without making all of their animators just drop dead from exhaustion.
Which they apparently did on this one, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But I would say that the next one just has to be bigger, even bigger. And I'm just racking my brain trying to figure out how they're going to do it.
Karin Soni's character will rip back with a vengeance. The happiest spider person we saw was the one voiced by Karin Soni, who's like, I work out, but I don't get too muscly. And, and just the unearned hubris and the joy spilling from that character really suggests that we're going to see a lot of him in the next movie. And like, he'll have his little arc, especially after he learns that he's just become a non-canon event. And I just, I can't wait to see what happens. I'm super excited to see how they're going to pull this off, especially when you get the gang back from the first movie and have 1,000 spider people and an extremely pregnant and angry Jessica Drew after you from the second. So, I just love the voice talent in this too. I mean, we've talked a lot about the visuals,
yeah,
but the casting that's done for this movie and the acting that everybody brings to it, I really feel like it's just been a really fortuitous match of actor and character and the way they choose to interpret them.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara especially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Yeah, this section with the whole, like, the canon events and everything and this whole theme of the movie, I thought was handled in a good way because they didn't really beat you over the head with it, because it's clearly a commentary on comic books and fandom and people wanting things to be the way it's quote-unquote supposed to be. And that could very easily go overboard into sort of like bashing the fans that you want to be watching and enjoying your movie. So I thought it was handled, I'm not going to say tastefully, I thought it was handled in a sophisticated manner, because it is a plot point in the movie. It is also meta-commentary, but at no point is anybody, sort of like, it doesn't get preachy, right? And the second thing about it is that, maybe people who know the comics know better than me, but watching the MCU and basically movies derived from comics or in the same genre, the tendency has been to go in the other direction, which is obviously why this is against, you know, the cliche. But like, I mean, I don't know the details of this because I watched this show so long ago and I don't know how it actually resolved, but like Flash going back in time to save his mom, right? Or lots of superhero movies where there's some kind of event that happened, or I guess even Spider-Man trying to go back and save Uncle Ben, or any type of thing where there's like some traumatic event that defines the character, and it's a common plot line is your hero gets obsessed with fixing that, right? And in all those cases, the media that I can recall seeing would be telling you, you can't fix that. You can't go back and save your mom. Uncle Ben's always going to die. Those are canon events. And the lesson of the movie is, the lesson for the viewer is like, don't get hung up on the past. The past is the past. Just move forward. Right. And this movie, while also having meta commentary about, you know, not getting stuck on what's quote unquote supposed to happen or who's quote unquote supposed to be Spider-Man. Like, that's obviously a theme of this whole series. This movie also says, also don't accept the idea that because someone tells you that this quote unquote is supposed to happen, if you have the power to change it, you can change it. And by the way, we as the storytellers are not going to punish you, you know, Greek myth style for hubris of defying the gods, right? Like that, I'm assuming the resolution of this movie is, you know what, Miles shouldn't have saved his dad, right? They're not going to do that to him, which is totally what all the other movies would do, is like, in the end, you shouldn't have gone back to try to save your parents, right?
The meta story here, and who knows where it will go in that third movie, but the meta story here seems to me to be so fascinating. It's basically Miguel O'Hara and his group seem to be committed to the idea that there's that in all of the multitudes of the multiverse, right? We've established that there are so many different universes, but yet Miguel O'Hara seems to believe there's only one Spider-Man story. And it has variations, but there's only one story that is ever told. And Miles and his crew, now that he's going to have, because Gwen forms that crew, and Hobie is part of it because he rebels against society and rages against the machine. I love it. Daniel Kaluuya, great little performance by him in this movie, too. their whole point is, no, there isn't. Right, that you write your own story. There isn't one story.
Everybody can be sympathetic because he has evidence. Like whenever like a canon event isn't allowed to happen, dark matter comes to destroy the whole universe. Right. So Miguel is sympathetic in that he has taken on the responsibility. He's like, look, I know what happens if you don't allow these canon events to happen. Worlds get destroyed, and I feel responsible for that. So it's my job to make the hard call to enforce it, because it's not just like I think this is quote unquote how it's supposed to happen. Literally, these universes get destroyed, and maybe he's seen universes be destroyed because of it, and so he is now 100% committed to, like, that's his, you know, it's an evil person, and everyone has their reasons, and his reasons do make sense. It's just that he's not able to even see the possibility that there may be another way.
In the story, they make sense. My point was just on a meta level, what the movie has got is these oppositional factions. One is saying there's only one story, and the other side is saying, no, you write your own story.
Right,
but yes,
right,
in the movie, like Miguel O'Hara is like, but I got to save the universe. If we don't tell the same story over and over again, the universe dies. Yeah,
right, and so that's what makes him be more sympathetic.
It's intention versus outcome, and O'Hara is like, I'm preventing this outcome. All of my intentions are centered on preventing this outcome. And Miles is pushing back with, I think we all have the same intention, and I think that we can do different things and still avoid the outcome.
Right. And if I had to put money down, it would be on the fact that in this story, Miles, the reason Miguel recoils at Miles' existence is because Miles' existence shows that there are other ways for the story to go, and that it isn't as simple a stay in your lane, stay on the main road as Miguel has thought it is all along, because he's repulsed by Miles's existence because of things happening in the metaverse. I suspect that is actually going to be the source of the solution, is that there's a bigger picture here and Miles is actually part
of Miles screwed things up. Like Miguel had a system, which is we just allow these canon events to happen and universes don't get destroyed.
Well,
and
maybe
Miles
Miguel is horrified because if Miles exists and there's a way to have him exist, he can be like, oh my heck,
but part of it is it's a problem that Miles exists.
Suffering things.
Like we could fix this by making Miles not exist. You know what I mean? Like
that the thing is if Miles' existence is allowed to continue and it turns out to be not a problem because of some extremely creative thinking, what Miguel has to do then is Miguel has to be like, holy cow, I have done all these terrible things in the name
all
of
these
preventing.
Uncle Ben's die.
I'm not entirely convinced that Miguel is who Miguel says he is. And I think that I'm reluctant to take at face value what Miguel has told us of himself in this movie. I think that there's a really long movie in part three coming up, and there's any number of things that could happen with him. Right. The other thing that I want to say, I want to go back to Meta World, where Jason was a little bit ago.
Come on up. I'm above the movie. I'm up here outside the movie.
The directors were also aware, and they've said so in interviews, that they were also aware of how Spider-Man fans of a certain generation and perspective reacted to Miles Morales when he was created in the comics and whether they accepted him. So there's a certain level here of the
of Miguel and the Spider Society rejecting Miles because he's not Peter Parker.
Right.
That that's a bit of a commentary on a fandom of the time as well. The directors are very much aware of that. So,
and I love how they populated all of the major characters in the Spider Society. There's so many women. There's so many people of color.
It's not 9,000 Peter Parkers, right?
It's also
not.
Some exactly. Cars and horses.
Yes, cars, horses, yes. Lego. Yes, mm-hmm. Also
Tyrannosaurs.
Mm-hmm. But like, you know, having characters like Spider Bite and Jessica Drew.
Yes,
and of course I can't get his name right. The Indian one.
Pavadir Prabhakar, which is literally they licensed the comic book to an Indian publisher and they invented this character who has now been pulled back into other Spider-Man stories, which is very nice. But you're right. I think that's also part of the irony here and also part of the plan of the storyline, which is, you can't really have a movie where there's 15 different alternate Peter Parkers who all look alike, mm-hmm. right? So but the result is you've populated this Spider Society with a whole lot of variants who aren't the one that we always thought, like, that it's just Peter Parker. So that even in that, the movie is saying Spider-Man was never just about Peter Parker. That's just the one that you mm-hmm. knew, and there are others, and Miles is mm-hmm. just one. But Gwen, it's funny too, because like Gwen is a very popular character now, and you know, I think in many ways it's because Miles paved the way and took the arrows about the idea that there could be more than one Spider-Man existence, and
that Spider-Man is an idea or a collection of personality traits and a point of view rather than just one specific person.
Now, and a collection of canon events in the comic books. I mean, like, it's not like every single Spider-Man had an Uncle Ben die, but a lot of them had similar stuff happen.
Yeah, exactly. That's like, because Miles's uncle dies too. It's not Uncle Ben, it's Uncle Aaron, and everybody's got and in Gwen, it's Peter Parker who dies, but it's all the same kind of things. Yeah.
As much as I enjoyed the Spider-Verse comics that we discussed on The Incomparable previously, it was ultimately, there were some extra characters in there, but it did feel like a Crisis on Infinite Parkers,
mm-hmm.
and this movie is much less so.
Oh yeah, I agree completely. This is a very different sort of thing with a broadcast. Now, actually, an interesting thing about the cast is that some of our favorite characters from the first movie don't appear much or at all until the end. So the No Spider-Ham, No Spider-Man Noir. Peter B. Parker is in it with Mayday, which is a great reference to the Spider-Girl comic in a Baby Bjorn. But Penny Parker shows up at the end especially. But like in a way, John, I think that is a way that they're doing a little bit of the Empire Strikes Back vibe of trying to give a shape to the three movies, is they withhold those characters either in total or in part.
They weren't there in the beginning. It's like, you know, with Empire, you have them together, then you separate, and then they come back together at the end. They were together in the first movie, then you don't really see them in this movie until later.
And then at the end, they're back, and they're part of the search for Miles. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was very effective in sort of saying, making this movie feel like something's missing, right? Where is Spider-Man Noir, and where is Spider-Ham, and where is Penny Parker? And we only see a little tiny bit of Peter B. Parker, and he's mostly off screen. It's kind of frustrating because, like, these are our friends from the last movie. Where are they? And the answer is, at the end, they're coming to save the day in the next movie. And I thought that was really effective, but I was also frustrated by it, because when we finally see Peter B. and little Mayday, I'm like, oh, look, it's got a happy story. And then he's like, off, he's like gone, and then he comes back, and it was frustrating, but I see what they're doing there, and it's clearing the decks for you to meet all these other characters, and knowing that when we're withholding them, we're going to give them to you at the end, when they come to save their friend. It's I think very cleverly done.
It's a little bit in hard mode, because like, you, the easy thing to do is, we're doing a sequel, hey, it's all the characters you love from the first movie, and they didn't do that in this one. The major characters are there, but then they said, well, now I have to invent all these secondary characters. I gotta bring them. I mean, again, they didn't invent them if they're from the comics or whatever, but Miguel, the Spot, all the, like, they did such a good job. Spider Bite, every new character in this movie is like, wow, they did it again. They're really good at making it. I mean, again, I don't know how many of these are from the comics, but I don't know any of them from the comics. So I'm like, look, here is a character not in the first movie who is new and interesting and seems like a real person and I want to see more of. They didn't just say, oh, it's your pals from the first movie and they're going to have more adventures, which would have been easier. I don't know if it would have been more or less satisfying, but I was delighted by how many things that were new to me were in this movie and how good all of them were. And then, yes, they pull them back in the end. It's like, oh, yeah, I remember those guys, too. Obviously, in the third movie, I presume they'll all be together, which will be very Avengers Endgame-y, but we'll see.
Yeah. And a lot of these characters, yeah, they were because there have been so many multiversal alternate spider people things in the comics, especially in the last 10 years, they have a lot of these. And the people who wrote a lot of those articles were consultants on these movies, too. And it all sort of feeds back and forth there. But yeah, it's fun to see them riff on this. The whole Ben Reilly Scarlet Spider thing is actually kind of a super super deep cut for the comic fans. The emo Spider-Man who's like, but I thought I was the wrong, you know, he's just,
I loved it so much. I couldn't stop
deep
laughing.
Deep cut, but very funny.
That was so great.
That's the best kind of reference because I have no idea about that comic, but I could still get the joke. Yeah. Because you could say there must be a comic where this guy's in it and he's super emo all the time, which you can totally see if you're vaguely familiar with how comics
and they're
making fun of it.
It's such a deep cut, John. He's drawn in a 90s style that was...
That I could definitely pick up.
It was so great.
Like,
it was so
great. It's just right there. It's really quite remarkable. Yeah. Let's see. What else do I have on my list here? I don't know. This is a... What else have we not talked about that we should talk about for this? Like it's a very rich stew of things of Spider-Men.
So I love the Donald Glover inclusion.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
he's one of the and one of the reasons I extra double love it is we're doing a community rewatch as a family this summer, and there's an episode where Donald Glover as Troy leaps out of his bed wearing Spider-Man pajamas, and Brian Michael Bendis has been like, okay, that is the moment I was inspired to create Miles Morales, and to see like a little bit of that come full circle later was just sort of a moment for me.
So
he was so funny.
And the story is that Donald Glover talked about maybe I should be the next Spider-Man when they were casting a new Spider-Man. And him wearing the Spider-Man pajamas is a reference to that, which then inspires Brian Michael Bendis to create Miles Morales, so that essentially there is a Spider-Man who looks like Donald Glover, which there wasn't before. And then in Spider-Man Homecoming, he is playing Uncle Aaron. He's the Prowler, and he actually says, I've got a nephew who lives in Brooklyn, which is itself a Miles Morales reference. So then to take it also... and have him in the movie, but also I love that the idea, what the movie is saying there is, you know, there are lots of animation styles, including this very realistic one that looks like live action. That is just another way to tell stories on film, people. Just it's like turning the tables a little and being like, oh yeah, live action is also, I guess, a valid film style in addition to all the
Except
animation
as I,
styles.
As I complained earlier.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's lesser, but still available as a animated live action style.
Yeah, I think one of the things this movie did really well is the basic sort of, this is setting aside like animation, this could have been people talking, like when Miles was talking to his family, the basic dialogue of these family scenes and the facial animation, it's talking heads. Miles is talking to his parents are scolding him about something, they're talking to each other about him. Those are usually in movies like this, don't have too much attention paid to them. It's just like, oh, hit the plot points. Parents are concerned about their kid, whatever. And I felt like, I don't know how else to say it, but the acting of Miles's mom and dad and Miles in those scenes, beautifully done. Like, again, nothing, they're literally talking heads. They're standing in a room and talking to each other, or even just Gwen talking to her dad. I was really impressed with the acting performances of essentially the animators and the voice actors combined, like in the way that they do, and the way that they do in a good animated movie where the animation combines with the voice actors to make one coherent performance. And these were just better than they needed to be for a Spider-Man movie, frankly, like in terms of how subtle they are and how beautifully animated and how heartfelt and how sophisticated the writing was. I was impressed by that.
Yeah, they actually, one of the animators shared on Twitter, they would film themselves saying the lines and going back and forth. And then they would animate, you know, they would use that as the basis for their animation. And the guy who did actually all three, Miles and both his parents in the counseling office, you know, he was literally, you know, gasping and, you know, throwing a hand up like mom and, you know, just rubbing his eyes like dad with his head down and, you know, just imitating, you know, imitating actual real expressions that that they were creating for themselves. You know, the care that they took, the time that they took to do that, you know, produced incredible results.
That's kind of the magic of animation. It's kind of like writing, where writing sometimes just like cheating, where you have basically unlimited time to figure out what words you're going to string together in what order, like before anyone sees it, right? So if you're writing a book or something, it's not performed in real time like a play. You can figure it out and take multiple attempts and delete and revise and edit and so on and so forth. And when you see animators doing that, where they're like filming themselves or looking in a mirror at their face or whatever, these animators are not Oscar award-winning actors. Right. So if you look at their performances, you're like, look, if that animator is up on screen, I'd say thumbs down. You're a lousy actor, because they're not actors. They're animators. But they have, I wouldn't say all the time in the world, given the working conditions, but they have time enough. Like, their skill is in animation. Mm-hmm. That is where their superpower is. So, yes, they need to know, like, they will act out their performances. But the performances you see in the movie are better than their little selfies because they're animators, not actors. And that's the magic of, like, yes, they need the reference. And yes, they're doing the best they can. But if they were on stage in a community theater, you'd be like, this actor is not great. But guess what? They're really
they use computers to move faces, not muscles.
It's like writing, because they have all the time in the world to tweak that eyebrow just so. And their skill is in knowing how should this move.
It kind of reminds me of Alex Ross, the painter / comics illustrator, because if you look at any of his books, he'll often have the photo inspos he used where it's like friends and family, and it'll be like somebody in an AC/DC t-shirt who's balding, and then he's turned him into Bruce Wayne, millionaire.
Yeah, finished product. It's like, what?
And it all comes from, he finds like some ineffable quality in the way somebody's standing or the cast of their expression. And then he layers on all of the storytelling meaning. And it's an astonishing skill set to have. It really is, John. That's a great point that you brought up.
I want to mention a couple things about the animation and about the live action. So first off, what superpower does Rachel Dratch have where she just gets to be herself in animation? Because it's literally the guidance counselor.
There's a lot of people like Rachel Dratch in the real world. And so you can put her in any movie, but people will be like, I met someone like that.
She doesn't need to open her mouth. And you're like, oh, they did an animation of Rachel Dratch. And it is Rachel Dratch. It's like, okay, fine. That's fine.
This is the character she played in Mr. Mayor, isn't it?
There's apparently... the live action moment that I was confused by, where they go to the live action convenience store, is a reference
to Venom. To Venom, apparently.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Sony, whatever. But
we own this too.
I mean, it was funny, but I had no idea. The first time I saw that, I was just like, okay, she's hilarious.
I did think it was funny, and I was a little bit perplexed about what was going on. I guess that's what happens when you don't get the references, right? Is you're like, oh, at least it worked. But the one that I wanted to mention that just, it left me so happy as I was leaving the theater, the first thing I said about this movie to Lauren, I turned to her and said, you know what? In every universe, J.K. Simmons is J. Jonah Jameson.
Yeah.
He's in multiple universes in this movie as J. Jonah Jameson, plus the other movies where he's J. Jonah Jameson. It's such a funny little Easter egg of like, yeah, there's always a Jonah, always. And it's always J.K. Simmons. And that's just how it is. You gotta deal with it. That was delightful.
He was in the Lego universe as J.K.
Yeah, it's always everyone. I mean, we do also, they use some clips, which I figured they probably would, but they use some clips of the live action Spider-Man movies, which is fun because it's like multiverse, everything mm-hmm. counts, everything's connected, and there's a line of dialogue about about Spider-Man No Way Home,
Doctor Strange and that kid,
yeah, right, like that it's all, you know, multiple Spider-Mans, infinite Spider-Mans includes all the ones you're thinking of, so yeah that was good stuff.
Even before they go to the web graphics of the Spider-Verse, they first show the same sort of fractal curved graphic of the multiverse that's been used in the Marvel movies so far. So, yeah, they're pulling it all together. One thing that I did want to mention that we haven't talked about is the music. And I think this is, I'm trying to decide whether I am less satisfied with the music in this movie compared to Into the Spider-Verse, because there were some singles and some score cues from Daniel Pemberton that were just absolutely monumental and Into the Spider-Verse. And I didn't come out of this movie humming it. And I don't know if it's because the content of the movie was just animation wise, story wise, and all that stuff was just so much more there that there's less of an opportunity to track the soundtrack or what. I was wondering what y'all thought.
There wasn't the big theme, like that Hello Danger theme song of the climax of the first movie was sort of iconic and associated with the movie. This score was a lot of soundtracky stuff that fit with the characters, but it wasn't the type of movie where there's going to be like character themes and overriding score that are going to be like an ever-present character on screen along with the ones that you can actually see. Like,
yeah.
It's not a, you know, I'm not going to say a John Williams style, but like, even like, you know, so obviously you think of like Star Wars, Indiana Jones, but even things like every Miyazaki movie, the music is so important and pervasive in those movies, to give an animated movie example, and it is used differently in this movie. I think it's used more in a more traditional manner than in the first movie, but in this movie, it was not as front and center. It wasn't an ever-present character.
There's no Hello Danger. There's no Sunflower. And when Miles takes the goober from Peter and says, don't watch the mouth, watch the hand, and then jumps, the music that was playing to that and Into the Spider-Verse, there really isn't an equivalent to that this time around.
One thing, just a theory, which is, again, that first movie was a little bit under the radar, and they were picking songs and integrating them. And I wonder if maybe this movie like had the eye of Sauron, except it's the eye of Sony, like looked at it and said, what Sony music artists could we place in this movie? And therefore it's maybe not quite as like, and even some big names, but it's like not quite the meaningful use of music that first movie. It not only the score, but the needle drops are on. Mm-hmm. They're just perfect. And here I didn't get that same feeling of like, oh, this is perfect, right? Didn't feel like
that. Music in movies is like a weird alchemy, because it's so often like, I mean, so obviously you have cases where the director has a really concrete idea of that the music should be important to the movie, because again, you know, all the Star Wars with John Williams, all the Miyazaki's with Joe Hisaishi, and like there is a clear vision there. They pick the person who's going to do it. They put it in, right? Then there are movies where like, oh, we don't have any budget and I want to get these songs and I want them so badly, but I can't get them. So let's put in some substitutes or whatever. And it still works out. So like Donnie Darko couldn't get any of the songs they wanted. They put in these other songs that were like second or third choices, but they work so incredibly well that when he finally got a chance to like, oh, now I can get the music that I want, everyone was like, no, go back to the old music, because that works, right? Or whatever the movie they just did on the Flophouse, where they, oh no, it was the Mario movie,
yeah,
where they had a score for the movie,
and they threw it out,
but then the executive said, take it out, throw in a bunch of pop songs, do needle drops. Did not work,
no.
Right? Or I don't know if the score was any better. And it's just such a weird alchemy that sometimes it's like, well, if the director gets what they want, the score will be strong. But that's not always the case. It's just like, does it work? Is this weird? It's not just a coin flip, but it's this weird mixture of like, I mean, for all we know, the first movie with like those songs that are like, oh, popular songs you should put in there, they worked because they fit with the movie and we come to associate it. Like the Donnie Darko songs. Like, there may not be the songs that the director wanted, but you watch Donnie Darko with Echo and the Bunnymen and you're like, yes, that I see it. It's together. It fits. It works. And then they're like, no, actually, I wanted it to be this song. And you're like, no. Nope. Don't like it as much anymore. So I don't know what, I wouldn't want them to go back in this movie and say, well, I really wanted to have these songs, but we couldn't afford the rights, because the soundtrack of this movie, even though it wasn't, you know, forward and dominant, I didn't need it to be forward and dominant. There's plenty going on the screen.
Yeah. Yes.
And I was never looking for something that wasn't there. The soundtrack and the music always felt like it fit with the visuals. And it was hard enough just to keep up with the visuals, because this is a very fast, very, you know, frantic movie.
Going back a bit to the room to breathe and the character interactions that we are allowed is just getting to see more of Miles's parents being present and their side of the story and into the Spider-Verse. Yeah, they're in his life. Yes, they're worried about him. You know, mom is there saying, you know, my little man, you can leave in a minute. You know, we get the heartfelt, you know, dad talking to Miles through the door of his dorm room. And here we get face-to-face conversations. We get the arguments. We get, you know, his mom, you know, going up and trying to talk to him and explain, you know, this is why we care so much, because we want you to feel, you know, that you can be anywhere and you can do anything, you know, which Miles takes to heart and then, you know, spits back out, I'm going to do my own thing at the climactic moment. I really loved having his parents present as characters. And in part, that was, you know, one of the things I'm slightly curious as to, like, Jason, you said you twigged on the wrong universe the minute 42 came up. For me, the first time I watched it, it took a few minutes. It took for a second, Miles falls into his bedroom and I'm like, that doesn't quite look right. And then his mom comes in the door and her eyes are green instead of brown. And she's just sort of like standing there and listening to him in sort of a helpless way that's different from what we saw of her before. You know, expanding on Miles's family was a really good call, in my opinion.
Yeah. The last thing I want to throw out is that this movie also expands on the first movie in other important ways. Why did the spider have a 42 on it? Why did it glitch?
Right.
And why, when Peter met Miles, why did Miles's background colors, when they were spider-sense vibing of it, why did the background colors change from Prowler purple and green to Spider-Man blue and red? You know, they knew where they wanted to take this thing if they got another couple of movies.
Yeah, it is. It's in there. Like, you can go back and watch that first movie, and it's very clear where that spider came from in the first movie. And then it's a plot point here. So good job to everybody for setting it up.
It's just thinking back to something I think Shannon said earlier about the walking up the stairs with the pizza boxes and how it's like, you know, Looney Tunes style animation. Now you can't do that in live action. And at first I was thinking about it like, well, you can do that in live action and it looks terrible. Like, cause it doesn't make sense to you, because you see, okay, you're trying to do cartoon physics, but you're not actually going to squash and stretch a person. Right. So it's just a regular person, but doing cartoon physics. And I think, and then I was thinking, okay, well, where have I seen that before? Where have I seen them try to do animation things with live action and it hasn't looked good? And I'm like, oh, sometimes that happens in superhero movies because superheroes, having their origin in comics, often are asked to do things that you can do in animation or you can do in still panels of a comic, but when you try to do them in live action, look silly, look wrong, look incongruent in a way that is difficult to work around. And it really got me thinking that, and then I got into this whole big spiral of like, the whole MCU should probably be animation, right?
Right? Talking earlier about the difference? It's too much.
Yeah, like if you think about the worst of the MCU movies, like the ones where it's not working, the scenes where it's not working, the whole movies where it's not working, it's very often because there is a clash between what they're trying to put on screen and our expectations for live action, for humans that look like humans in a real world with real buildings and real cars and real people, and the way that you can make them move that fits, right? And it's not to say you can't have photorealistic animation, but these movies are live action. They're not photorealistic animation. And so they're, you know, despite the fact that they can do superhero things, if you make someone move like a cartoon, or even if you just do cuts or framings or jumps from this to that, that would work in animation, but feel wrong in live action. And that, you know, I don't think the MCU has sort of properly dealt with that. Obviously, when you do live action and play to its strengths, you can be very artful, see the whole world of cinema. Like, it's not like, oh, you're trapped and you can't make good movies. You can do tons of stuff. You can even make really good live action superhero movies. We have plenty of those too. But it's when you try to, like, you reach for something that would be better in animation because it's a thing that happened in a comic, because you have this idea. But you've got live action people and you've already established them as live action, that doesn't fit. And that you're sort of freed from that in animation. So animation does give you the freedom to do whatever you want. But I feel like with superhero characters in particular, the MCU or Spider-Man or whoever, whatever the next big franchise thing, the lesson they should take from this is they should give up on the notion that you should essentially have live action as the default for your storytelling. And by the way, you're allowed to have one animated sub thing, right? That should be the lesson of the Spider-Verse, is that animation is not just for Pixar movies, Miyazaki, anime, and, you know, and one or two other movies. Like, that it should be a valid choice, and you should pick it with the knowledge of your genre. And by all rights, if you look at the entire MCU, way more of those movies should be animated, right?
Oh,
and
man,
I'm just
list.
Glad that we've got we've got this one, and it's like, oh well, this is just the Black Swan, they just made this amazing movie and it's animated. It's like, you can do this again. Give animators money, allow them to do stuff. And I'm not going to dump on Pixar, but they have like their house style or whatever, but there's more to animation,
yes,
than Pixar, and there's more to animation than Miyazaki. And like, if you watch, like, you know, there's lots of really interesting stuff going on in animated shorts and stuff that are just not stuff that you see in the Oscars, but like random animated shorts, the Star Wars animated things that they're doing, the stuff you see on the Netflix thing, Love, Death, and Robots. People have creative ideas and interesting things they can do. Imagine finding a couple of them and giving them lots of money and some franchise IP to guarantee butts in seats and see where they go with it.
Imagine what Marvel's What If could have looked like if they'd leaned into this kind of multiverse approach to animation.
As opposed to, we're going to try to
I like the What If style, right? But I don't, you know, it's like, you really need the freedom. Like, I think the people who made this got a little bit of a freedom to do it because, you know, hey, they made the Lego movies and they're good or whatever. It's tough. I think it's probably a tough sell. If you came out of nowhere and said, I wanted to make the Spider-Verse, you would be like, nope, sorry, that's not going to happen. No one will watch that, right? So you do have to get people with a little bit of prestige and skill and the ability to get money to take a chance on you to do something like this.
Yeah, I feel what I said when that last movie came out was, we're very lucky to have this. But you're right, John. I think that this, what they are showing here. Also, let's say, you know, Sony has made some very weird choices in their various Spider-Man, you know, you know, you got your Morbius and your Venom and your Kraven the Hunter and all that. Like, the priorities of live action and animation are different, and the pipelines are different. And, you know, I also, the truth is, the audience reaction, that the fact that first movie wasn't as well received in terms of box office as it should have been was down entirely to the fact that it was an animated movie. And it just, that very thing turned people off from seeing it, when in fact it was a remarkable achievement. So I feel that way about, I mean, the good news is that the word got around about that movie, because this movie made more money than that movie in like week one, which shows you that over the years since it first came out, the first Spider-Verse movie has been watched by a lot of people and appreciated by them. But this shows you, yeah, this is a genre that has had wild success with live action, but yet you see the artistic possibility, the creative possibility of using animation to tell these stories. And it's dazzling, right? My understanding is that they are planning to do more animated movies in this format, so that Sony is not just making part two of that, but there are other movies that they're planning to do that are animated, which is good, because they have really shown a path here. And I would love to see Marvel actually say, you know what, we are also going to make an animated movie. Does Disney employ animators, by the way? Are there any does Disney own any animation studios? Oh, right, they have two.
and it's so weird because the comics are so free in changing their art style to match the specific Spider-Man that they're doing, you know, forget yeah. about different characters, but like, the comics are so free to change their art style, and the movies are so constrained. Like, I was even thinking of something like Invincible on Amazon, right? The animation in that was very conventional. the Invincible story is not conventional, and I get the contrast where it's kind of like, you know, a Superman story playing against type or whatever, but I can imagine an Invincible, a rated R Invincible movie with a very different animation style that fits the story. Same thing, you know, Superman type proxy, subverting Superman type tropes or whatever. It would look nothing like the Spider-Verse, but I think it would pair well with this, with that Invincible story, as far as I know, because I never read the comics, just watched the show. That could be super interesting. And so I'd really hope they just sort of take the reins off and say, like, because the worst thing you could possibly do is say, we're going to make an MCU movie and it's going to be in the Pixar house style. Like, it's called The Incredibles, okay? You're not going to top that. Just stay away. Do something different.
Right, but you could do something different and it could be interesting. And that's, you know, when we give credit to the MCU on this podcast over the last, you know, decade, one of the things that we credit them is that they do take chances in telling stories that are different and feel different and have different genres that they play with. And then we keep saying, yes, more of that, please, more. And this is a great example, which is like, it is, I think, kind of telling that Sony, because they have the Spider-Man license, was able to make these movies. And Marvel, for all of the money that it's made, has, and the fact that it's part of Disney, has not. And Big Hero 6 doesn't count, people. It's great, and it was based on a Marvel comic, but it doesn't, it's not the same. But, like, why have they not said, why don't we try some different storytelling styles than the live-action, you know, machine that is extruding two Marvel movies a year? Why don't we try something different? Because look what Sony did with Spider-Man, right? Like, there is a fertile ground to be harvested here if Marvel, or, you know, quite frankly, if anybody else. And I know DC and Warner Brothers do actually release animated films based on their IP. They're not necessarily as ambitious as Spider-Verse, but, like, I want more ambition in American animation, and especially I want more ambition with these amazing bits of intellectual property that are the most popular movies that are being made now. And this is the prime example. I think this is, like, the perfect example. Look what they did. And the first one won an Oscar, and this one expanded the canvas. Like, there should be more movies like these movies.
Ambitious is good. Bottom line. Ambitious is very good.
Yeah, it is very good. All right. We will return to talk about part three at some point, maybe next year. They have a release date, but everybody agrees it's not going to happen. This movie got delayed a year, so, like, who knows? But hopefully sometime next year for part three of this story involving Miles Morales and many, many other spider people. But until then, let me thank my panelists for talking about this particular spider movie. Lisa Schmeiser, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Shannon Sutter, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Chip Sutter, thank you.
Hope I didn't ice your game, man.
And John Syracuse, thank you, as always.
I regret to inform you that this episode is a canon event, so you will not be able to edit it.
Oh, no. Well, bad news. Bad news for Steven, our editor. Don't break canon or everything ends in sadness and dark matter.
Or does it?
Or does it? Maybe he should do his own thing. Anyway, we will be back with another episode of The Incomparable soon. Until then, goodbye, everybody.